I like to start these out by just sharing some general things again about ritual. And one thing I'd like to share first is just how much ritual is a community thing. The kind of ritual we're talking about is the very definition of a community could be it's a people who share a ritual and understand it. Now, and we could take an example, and I heard this from a Walt Bowman tape, is that in a way our culture is a community, and part of that community is shared rituals. Like when two people come together to meet, you don't have to sit there and stand there and discuss what actions you do in meeting. You know, I put my hand out, the other person puts hand out, and we shake, you know, and your arms go up like that. And more than about five would start to be inappropriate. Do you know what I mean? And so then you put your hand down, and this has become a form of shared understanding of meeting. And then you get an idea how a community shares a ritual. If you're in Asia or something, reach out your hand as the other person is bowing. You know, where it's two different, in a way, communities of understanding. You're very aware of this when you sit in on another community of faith. And you look and see what they're doing, and it just seems so strange. And it's why in Larry Rasmussen's journal, I'll never forget it, he wrote in his journal after visiting a Hindu temple in India, he just wrote the simple sentence, "Religion is odd." And then reflecting on his own, then underneath that in his journal, he wrote, "The sacraments are," did he say weird or odd? Do you remember? I think it was weird. He said, "The sacraments are weird." Sometimes just sit through a Eucharist and pretend like you've never seen this. And listen to people passing this cup and saying, "Blood, blood, blood, blood." You know, and when a community has a shared understanding, then it makes sense. Also, to deeply know another people is to know their ritual. I know once in Albuquerque, I had a Muslim friend, and just even the little I knew about the ritual of Islam made him feel so much like I had taken a little time to know him, because I took a little time to know his people and know his community of faith. I brought this chart out again, this paragraph, and I think I read it at the very beginning of the 10 weeks, but I'd like to read it again just from the context of what we've studied. The early Christians were subject to terrible criticism from the Roman Empire, the people who were not Christians, because of misunderstanding of their ritual. And some of the persecution came really because of several criticisms against the Christian community. One, they were accused of being atheists because they didn't believe in the Roman God. They were called atheists. They didn't believe in the Roman gods. Secondly, they were accused of child sacrifice. These were the rumors that spread around because the common people knew that something they did when they got together had something to do with blood. Can you just imagine how these rumors started to spread around? And so also the rumor that they drank blood when they got together. And you can see how it wouldn't be that hard to start thinking that. So Justin wrote what was called an apology, and an apology in ancient writing was not the way we use the word apology, like, "Oh, I'm so sorry for the way I am." But an apology was a clear statement of your position and what you do so those outside really understand it. That is called an apology. So part of the Lutheran confessional writings are the apology to the Augsburg Confession, which is an attempt to make a clear statement of what it actually is. Justin, a second century Christian who was martyred, wrote an apology to be read by the Roman world as to what we, to neutralize the gossip. He wrote this so people would know exactly what they did, the Christians did when they got together. So it's interesting, from that we get this statement of what the Christians did when they met on the Lord's Day. And would you read it, Spence?
On the day called after the sun, all gathered for communal celebration. The memoirs of the apostles are read as long as time permits. Then the one presiding admonishes his hearers to practice these beautiful teachings. We say prayers in common for ourselves, for the newly baptized, and for all others throughout the world. Then bread and wine are brought to him who presides over the community. He gives praise and glory to the Father in the name of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and gives thanks at length for the gifts which we have received from him. The whole crowd standing up cries out in agreement, Amen. Amen is a Hebrew word and means, so may it be. Then the bread and the wine, over which the thanks had been offered, are distributed among all those present. This food is known among us as the Eucharist. The deacon brings a portion to those who are absent. Those who are well-to-do give whatever they will. What is gathered is deposited with the one presiding, who therewith helps orphans and widows.
Okay, where do you see manna in the second century worship? The sense of manna. Yeah. And notice who are the ones that give. You know, I'd be interested what their definition of well-to-do was. You know, from our manna mentality, anybody that has excess of what you simply need to live would be called well-to-do. And then that was distributed. So you notice more food was brought than was needed for the Eucharist, and then the extra was brought. Who were the absent? Probably inactive members? Probably mainly the ill or the aged, and they would bring then the Eucharist. A deacon was the one who served, would bring the church that my parents belonged to in San Diego. It's very interesting. At the time of the offering, they bring the bread, wine, offering plates, and an attaché case to the altar. And then I looked at this, as that doesn't seem that religious. You know, an attaché case put on the altar, so that also is there at the time of the Thanksgiving. And then after the service, one of the deacons comes up, picks up the attaché case, and it's the communion for the sick. And then they move out then to all the people that they know in the congregation who are sick or shut in, to let the sense of community spread to those who are not able. It's really a restoration of an early Christian practice. And it's done by lay people. You know, it's something we've taught, that especially elderly people are taught, that they can't share the sacrament unless the pastor comes. You know, and it takes some teaching for them to learn that the deacon or the deaconess or any lay person comes. Does the early Christian worship seem dull by this? If you notice, they all stand up and cry out their amens. I often think maybe it's kind of a combination a Greek Orthodox liturgy and Pentecostal revival, kind of put those two together in one one package and you might be close. Notice how in the prayer is not only for Christians, but the prayer is for the whole world. How this, the sense of manna, is spread from just being one little community or tribe. It's the end of tribalism. In the prayers, you reach out to the whole world. And now, I wanted to bring this up again. Just, it's another reminder to us that the main liturgy of Christian people is the Eucharist. And we're going to see how natural it is once you sense this, that when you sense this, then at an important time of ritual in a Christian's life, it is the most natural thing to share the Eucharist. In fact, you don't even sit down and try to explain it. It just seems right. You know, an example is Steve and Tammy's wedding. You know, we didn't have a long, long discussion about whether we'd share the Eucharist at this wedding. It just seemed like it's the way we give thanks. It's the way we share community. You know, the bigger discussion would be to try to decide why we shouldn't do it. My parents celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary a year ago January, and it just seemed natural at the wedding anniversary celebration to share the Eucharist. Again, it would have been more an argument of why not to do it, you know, when that is so much a sense of when a community gets together, this is how we ritualize what life is. And now we're going to see that as we move into the liturgy or the ritual of the burial of the dead. I want to start by just reading a few things from Ernest Becker. It's wonderful when you're a Christian to read great things from Jewish agnostic psychoanalysts like Ernest Becker. I don't think he's an agnostic. But we need to read words of truth, I think, that are outside of our community of faith. Helps us remember that we don't own God, which I'm sure all of you know. The whole book, The Denial of Death, he uses his understanding of psychoanalysis to show how the human being, our whole life, every day, practically every morning, every moment of every day, we're touched by the reality of our death. And the final truth that as you look around this room, every body here in this room will rot away in the earth or burn or something. There's none of us that's going to make it out of this alive. Short of the rapture, or Elijah and Moses made it, didn't they? Or did they?
Enoch.
Oh no, Enoch and Elijah made it, but they're an exception. So he shows in this book how our whole life is fighting against death. One, the child wants to conquer death by becoming the father of himself, the creator and sustainer of his own life. In other words, the narcissistic project, and he uses that word narcissistic project, is kind of our life project to try to work our whole lives as if death were not going to happen, or to fight it by trying and fighting to sustain our own life. Using the body as a primary base of operations, and he says, unfortunately, it's doomed to failure. Our project is doomed to failure. This book is really happy entertainment reading. He defines a human being as an angel with an anus. You know, that's what he's about. and just think of it, the mighty spiritual heights to which the human being can fly into the great spiritual realms, and right in the middle of your great spiritual experience you have to go. You know, and he really means that when something that physical happens, it bugs us because it reminds us that just as every animal dies, this animal is going to die. And then we're beaten because we fail to face up to the existential truth of our situation, the truth that we are an inner symbolic self, which signifies a certain freedom, but we are bound to the finite body, and this finite body that's going to die limits our freedom. If this book were written in a simpler way, it takes a lot of work to read through this book, but if it were written in a simple way, it would be required reading before baptism. Because when we say in baptism we die, it simply means by going into the water of baptism we accept the reality of death long before it happens. And that means we just give in to death. And in a way, if you have a deep sense of baptism, the threat of death is in your past and not your future. That doesn't mean the threat of death, of course, lingers. But what is the threat of death but the end of all the gods and idolatries and plans and programs to which we cling? And in the water of baptism, symbolically, we give that all up. We die to all of that. The problem of death, ideally, if we understand baptism, the problem of death is taken care of. Well, that's a little background. Now, before we just start discussing, I'd like to just have us turn just to one other person in twos and just share maybe a time in your life when death was very close, maybe not to you personally, but when it meant the death of a grandparent or a loved one. If it's too close, it'd be too emotional to be comfortable sharing, share something else. Don't let me push you into a situation that you don't feel comfortable with. But, well, I mean, of course, we'll all be a little uncomfortable, but share a time when death was right there, funeral, loved one, maybe you came close. That'll certainly zero our minds into what we're talking about. So just do that in twos then. Charles, do you want to do me?
One of my grandparents died. I never knew of him very much. I only saw him a few times in my life. Your grandfather. Never. I suppose it's my other grandfather died. He was 85. His brother lived to be 97.
He's got a few years to do it.
I think it was. I think I remember seeing the celebration. Exercise is to just pull us together on this and then hold, you know, hold where your mind is, because what I'd like to do now is share two rituals of burial, or two funeral rituals that I've experienced, and then think of your experience of death, and then when I finish sharing my two rituals, let's talk about that. First of all, how, especially the time of death, if there's ever a time that ritual is needed in human life, it's here. To take life and compress it into some word, an action, event. In the congregation I served in Albuquerque, it was a 90-year-old congregation, which meant it had a lot of old people. And somehow all of these older people knew each other, and they kind of passed around this idea that funerals are arrogant. You know, we don't want people to fuss over us. So just before they died, they'd often leave this message, "I don't want a funeral." And then you'd have to keep their wishes, so you'd have a 5-minute graveside. And I remember how depressed I was after this 5-minute graveside when you thought, here is 80, 90 years of life, 80 or 90 years of offering of life, of giving of life, of family, of friendships, and you go to a graveyard and you say about 2 prayers and 1 Bible verse and then walk away. You know, that if there's ever been a time when I had a deep sense of the need for ritual, and it even happens here at the village in a similar way, how you need that ritual hug at the end of the Holden experience, and there are people that say, well, I don't want to do that. So they'll figure out some way to sneak down to the lake so people won't have the goodbyes, and you feel robbed of ritual. Do you know what I do you know what I mean? And then,
before the funeral for my father-in-law's second wife, and at the time he was 90 and she was about 80, I guess. And before they actually had the funeral, he was in a nursing home, tech worker, and I said, I lost all three. And he no doubt meant his mother years ago, and then his first wife 30 years ago, and then Esther. And he was just at a loss until the funeral itself.
Yeah. It was hard, but Jenny's death was hard for me because I missed all the rituals. I wasn't back in Chicago for that one, and I wasn't here at Holden for the memorial service here. You know, I never had that chance to be with people to do that. It, to me, I feel like I haven't done something that I need to do in relation to Jenny. Well, okay, here's my first story. Okay. I came into my office at the church and there was a note on my desk that Elmer Schweitzer had died. And so I called Mabel, the widow, now to get the idea. This name is made up and everything, but it's a very typical situation. So Elmer was kind of a nominal, came to church most Sundays, but wasn't real active in the church, and I'd called on him in the hospital sometimes, so I got to know him and his wife, Mabel. So I call Mabel, and then I make an appointment that afternoon to go over to the house. And so I come at 3 o'clock, and I drive up, and the family is already there with Mabel, 2 sons and their wives, and then 1 daughter. And most of them don't go to church, so when I walk in, there's this dead silence. The reverend has come. So I sit down, and everybody kind of assumes now that things have to get religious. So, but first of all, we talk about Elmer, because I learned in seminary, and I think it's good. It is good that the first thing besides hugs, you know, which you do when you walk in, is to just let a person talk about the loved one. So things get a little more relaxed as we sit and talk and share tears. Then the business comes up, and when the pastor's there, that has to come up. We have to plan the funeral. And the first thing is I get bad news. They've already been to the funeral director without me talking to them first, which means no doubt that they've bought a very expensive casket and maybe have... and one thing, this is... I'm glad I heard this. It's your mother, Karen, that's a funeral director?
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes, we can lash out against. Has your mother ever been lashed out against?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But, oh, go ahead.
No,
okay. A funeral director is a business, and there's no funeral director would deny that. And a thing, just as a store is set up in a good business-like way, like a casket showing room is set up in a good business-like way to encourage the proper sale of a good funeral, a good casket. You know, so that's one thing I felt bad like at this funeral, that I didn't get there first. So of course they had bought a very expensive casket and a watertight vault. you know, so nothing would drip on the casket. Very expensive. Then, before we could talk about the service, I found out it's already been decided the service will not be at the church because that's too much fuss. And the funeral director encouraged them to have it at the funeral home because it's all the fuss of going to the church. So Almer will not be buried from the place where he shared the Eucharist and shared worship with the Christian family. It'll be in this chapel. And then the only advice then I get is keep it short and simple. Do you remember that? Keep it short and simple. So then I explained the funeral service to the family. And then I say, by the way, and then I'm always nervous when I bring this in. I say, by the way, I need to tell you, in the Lutheran funeral service, the casket is closed before the service started and it is not reopened. Then after I say that, I hope they catch my authority. And then Mabel nods in agreement, that's okay, so then I'm kind of relaxing. But then Bill, one of the sons, reminds us that Uncle Harry will be late, so he won't get to see Elmer. And then I see it all crumbling. And then Cynthia, the daughter, says, I really want to see Dad once more after the service. So then we finally, then the little message goes into my head that is right, you don't teach theology to a family at the time of grief. I mean, this is not the time for a big argument. So we agree, finally, that the casket will be closed before the service, and then it will be closed during the service, and then reopened so Cynthia can see Elmer once more. Then we talk about flowers, and I finally am able to talk the family out of flowers and a memorial gift. These are some of the things you see pastors go through. Then gather the family in the home and have a prayer together. Then I go back to the office to call the funeral director, and I tell him that we'll close the casket before the service and open it after, and then he tells me it'd be easier to leave it open during the service, and then I get stubborn and say, no, we're going to close it during the service, and then he resentfully says, okay, we'll close it during the service. Okay, now it's time for the funeral, and I arrive at the funeral home 20 minutes early. There I walk first in, and I see Almer now in his bed. And the caskets today are like beds. In fact, when my Aunt Ebba died 7 years ago, we walked into the room, and we were asked if we wanted regular or inner spring. And I remember wanting to say to this salesman, you know, don't you understand, Ebba is dead. You know, inner spring. But this, did your mother have inner spring? Oh. Yeah. And then, I look. The first thing you notice is I looked at the coffin and I kind of had them figured out. It was kind of upper moderate casket. Now notice how our the same thing that we do with people's cars that they drive now, we're doing with the casket. And I look at it and say, oh, upper middle. Okay, then on either side of the casket are pink lights. And this makes the face look better and more natural, and the color of the face look better. And then people now are coming in and looking at Elmer, and they're commenting on how he looks and how well the funeral director did at fixing him up, since he was not a very good-looking man in the first place. They did a good job. Okay, now I'm back there too, so I can meet the family as they come in and give Mabel a hug. Just give her a little word of compassion, and the other people in the family. I hug Mabel and I shake everybody else's hand. And then they're ushered into the family area. Now here's a setup in the funeral home. There's about 30 people that come to the service, and they sit out in the chapel. Then the casket is open up in front, and then off to the side, there's a screen over the family, so these people can't see them crying. Have you been in a funeral chapel like that? So then I go up to my little podium there, and right below me is Elmer, and now the funeral director comes and closes the casket resentfully. And then I see through this kind of screen, I see the family in there, and then I see the 30 people out here, and then I read the service, and I do all of the reading. And the only part that they participate in is everyone says the Lord's Prayer, but that's the only place where they participate. Oh, by the way, I met the organist then just before the service, and I say I'm a Lutheran, and so she says, "What kind?" So then I say, "The Green Book kind." So she pulls out the Green Book. She has Presbyterian, Methodist, Roman Catholic, Missouri Synod, Green Book, Presbyterian. Did I say Presbyterian? And then I tell her I want good Lutheran hymns, so she doesn't play In the Garden. And then, so I get that figured out. And then after the about a 10-minute service, then they come and reopen the casket, and everybody walks by. And then the family walks by last, and Mabel walks by very last, and then I stand next to the casket, and then so when Mabel's having the final view, I can give her a hug. And then I get in the hearse, and then we drive to the cemetery, and the family is in the limousine behind, and you get to look back and see this long line of people, and you feel power because all the traffic has stopped as you're going through, and then you talk. Then on the way, you talk to the funeral director who's driving the hearse, and there's a certain camaraderie between clergy and funeral directors in that you joke. Do you remember?
Sure.
Yeah, you joke.
And, great story.
Yeah, and you have stories you tell about your funniest funeral. So you're here behind you in the limousine is this family all sobbing, and then in the hearse with the body behind you, the clergy and the funeral director telling jokes. So now you're knowing some of the inner secrets. And you drive up to the cemetery. And then I guess it's important that's at a funeral where you don't really know somebody really well. Okay, then after there's a little committal service then. It takes about 5 minutes. And then the big final event is you leave the casket dangling over this hole. And then around the casket there is plastic grass covering up the dirt piles because you don't want any sense that this is dirt and this is earth and this person is actually going to the earth, so you're dangling there. And then you all get in your cars. And I like when we drive away, I always like to look behind because then the little shovel men are coming out from behind their hiding places. And just before you go around the corner, if they aren't good enough at waiting, you can see them taking the plastic off of the dirt, and you finally see, my goodness, that's real dirt stuff. That person must be dead. You know, and by that final look, you have kind of the first reality touch that maybe this person really is dead, except for the words that are said in the funeral meditation. Now, I want to switch, because I'm sure we'll have discussions. I want to switch and tell about another. And what I've shared is fairly typical, would you say,
Bill? I've never had one.
Oh, you haven't had. I think it's the areas of the country where you serve.
I think that's fairly common. Maybe it's just Lutherans that don't do it.
Oh. But would you say it's more common to have it open through the service and reopened at the end? My final thing that I always have, my last card I've never used, is. when people really want to have the body showing during the service, I always want to say, oh, you want to do it like the communists do it in Russia. But I've never done that. But it is true, though, if you notice, though, in Russia, that it's always the funeral is centered around the body, and the body showing. I won't do that. Let me tell my other story, and then let's just get to those open questions of discussion. Because as you notice, at least I think the way I said it, I made it sound like it's a rather important the question of to do or not to do is an important point. Another funeral was Grandma Flossie, and she was a old member of our church in California, and she was a mountain woman. She'd grown up in the mountains like of Carolinas, and had grown up a Baptist and had never been Lutheranized, and it was one of the beautiful things about her. Although she was a member of our Lutheran church, she had a simple piety, a simple faith. She had a beautiful attitude about death and dying. I remember once seeing her before a surgery that had a 5% chance of success. She had a 95% chance of dying, and I remember rolling down the hall of the hospital with her before she went into surgery, and as the two doors opened and I couldn't go in, we were both crying and holding our hands as we separated and said goodbye to each other. I went back to the hospital the next day. She was sitting up in bed with her feet dangling over the... Just said, I'm not ready yet. Decided I wasn't ready. But about 2 months after that, Grandma Flossie died. Just with the family, we saw the body. And that's important. When the closest person in my life died, my Aunt Eb, it was very important for me to just see the body once. You know, for me to really, really know she is dead. You know, and that's a vastly different thing than looking at this cosmetic thing and marching by it and having everybody comment that doesn't need that. But I needed that, and we needed that. And then we cremated Flossie before the cremation. We had the committal. That was the closest friends and family. And then the congregation came to the church, and we all just met at the church outside, family, Grandma Flossie, her daughter, son, grandchildren. Then we went around and we had the church. We had chairs in that church, so we had it circled around the altar, around the altar table. We sang joyful Easter hymns, just wonderful Easter hymns about how Christ had conquered death. The Easter candle was right by the altar. It was lit to remind us of Easter and also to remind us of Flossie's baptism. We read scriptures that focused on resurrection, and the family read the scriptures. The grandchildren read the readings. And also we had sharing about Flossie's life. People, both in just comments they got to stand up and say, and also in the prayer of the church, we just said things about Flossie, and we laughed about some of the Flossie's quirks. And we did some crying, and then the sermon was a proclamation of both thanksgiving for her life and celebration of the resurrection. The passing of the peace went on and on because we all hugged the family, and there were tears during the passing of the peace. Then the offering was marvelous. We brought the bread and wine to the altar, but also the grandchildren carried to the altar the stuff of Flossie's life. We brought her afghans, and we brought her knitting needles, and we brought her canning, and we brought her worn-out Bible all the stuff that had been the offering of Grandma Fossey's life now becomes, in a way, a symbol of offering. And it was fun. The altar was just cluttered with all her stuff. And in the midst of all our stuff, the bread and wine. And then we shared the Eucharist together. And then as soon as the Eucharist was over, the doors of the church kitchen opened. You know, and we had this wonderful feast with still some tears, but also a lot of laughing. And during the feast of food, we shared jokes about Flossie's life and her some more funny things about her. Well, that was a beautiful, beautiful funeral. It was in the best sense counter culture. I remember just some other memories too. The two funerals have been closest to my life. One was Karen's father about 6 years ago, and then my aunt Ebba 8 years ago. And at Karen's father's, we had the casket there and found the importance of the pall. Do you know the word pall? It's a white cover that goes over the casket, and it's a symbol of the covering of baptism. But in a much more important sense, the pall covers the economics of the casket. It levels everyone, and it's what takes away any sense of what economic range is this person in. Then this was hard in a small Minnesota town to get this across, but we told the funeral directors to leave the plastic grass out so we could see real dirt. And they really thought we were crazy, but when you're in grief, you can get away with anything. When you're in grief, take advantage of it. People just will bow and scrape. So if you don't want plastic grass, you know, there's nothing they can say. And then we chanted psalms. We chanted psalms of hope as the coffin was lowered into the ground. And there was such a deep sense of closure and a deep sense of reality. And then put dirt onto the coffin. And we do it with the funeral like we do with the Eucharist. We make little wafers that don't look like bread. Or with baptism, we have little dabs of water that don't really remind us of water. So at a funeral, I did this, and I remember a father, every clergy, or at least Lutheran clergy, has a little bottle of dirt, but it's really nice dirt. And you have that in your glove compartment, so it's always there at a funeral. Then you take that and you pour a little of it on the coffin and make the sign of the cross. This is a leftover from what really should happen at a committal, and that is a shovel. And I've been to funerals where families have had the freedom to bring shovels, and the family shovels the dirt onto the coffin. And now notice the gamut we've gone to from the first funeral I described, where the ritual is set to really do what all of life does, and that is deny death. If all of life denies death, then when you move into your ritual, there's a harmony. See, there is a harmony between that life and that ritual. But the vast difference of a family crying, and let them cry, and let us cry, shoveling dirt right into the hole. The question is how, if we live the Christian life of hope and baptism, accepting the reality of death, how do we ritualize that in a way that celebrates it in the same way comforts us and helps us work through our grief? That's all I want to share. Now let's just talk about what about your grandparents, your parents, or yourself? You know, what ritual would really say what our life is in this and really say what our counterculture life is. How do we do that when we die? Do you want, Sonia, do you want to raise that again about?
Yeah, how come?
Say the question again.
What's the matter if the casket is open or closed?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's. Well, instead of my just saying, trying to answer it, what do you think? The way I would start to answer is how very, very important visual things are in a ritual. And if a casket is open, there's absolutely no question that that body is the very visual center of what you're doing. And then you have to ask the question, well, when Christians gather to worship now and do what we do in a funeral, is this what we want to be the absolute center visual symbol? And my answer no to that would be, first of all, a lot of the desire to have it visually shown is the art of the embalmer. That every artist wants to show off his or her work. I mean, I've done enough art to know that the fun part is having people look at something you're proud of. Is that, am I?
Yeah, so then people can, they come see the body before they can do it.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But I think the center thing is that our first, we believe that this body is done. You know, it's on its way to death. So we don't center our visual experience around this, and yet it's present there, but it's just simply we want the center thought to be resurrection, God, Eucharist, altar, table, community. And the other reason is there's a certain work that you have to do when you're going through grief, that you go through one and then you move beyond that as you move on your grief work, and it just seems to be a much better process. Death comes, you hear the word of death, you of course go through the denial at first, the reality sinks in that this person is really dead. It's a very important visual thing at that time to see the body, so the reality of death sinks in. And then there's a time at which that has to stop, and then you close that, and then you move to a sense of worship, thanksgiving for this life, thanksgiving for the word of hope and resurrection. And then the kind of movement of it doesn't seem appropriate then to kind of open it up and go back to that. So it would be both of those, but Jean.
I really agree with that, because that's the way my mother died, that's the way my family did it. But also being from another perspective, I'm wondering about, what about friends, you know, that aren't family members? Do they also need to have that kind of encounter with the body, and how would that be done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where I think it's appropriate to... you know, people can go to the funeral home, see the body, or even if it should be open before the funeral service, but then closed and not reopened. But I personally don't think if you're not really close to somebody, you don't need to see the body.
It's true, if you want to, you can go to the funeral home.
Yeah, but I think the reason why people go to the funeral homes is to go to visit with the people, the family members who are there, and there's always those terrible conversations, like you say. You know, they're standing in some reception line or some room where they're so close, and you go up and you say how sorry you are, and you don't know what else to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, you're not there to see the body and finalize it for you. It's yuck.
What about closing the casket, though? I mean, in sight of everyone. Do you think that's a good, effective ritual? Or?
Yeah, I think I hadn't thought that much about it, but I.
It's just even when I don't know the people and I'm doing the funeral, those guys march down and clock that casket down here. The family goes nuts. I just want to fall apart.
Maybe it is, and most funeral directors I've worked with, as you usher everybody into the church, then close the casket and then bring it in. Maybe it's an unnecessary emotional thing.
Sometimes they'll pull the screen across in front of the family and then close it, but I mean, there's all the friends out there.
I think some... You know, I think the emotion of lowering the casket, I mean, that's a very emotional thing, but I also think that's something that shouldn't be denied. You know, do you sense that the unreality of going off from a committal and leaving the casket kind of dangling over this hole that it's...
Remember that monumental, wonderful movie Love Story? But Ryan O'Neill, if you remember, stayed there for hours until they came and buried her.
I remember too, though. I remember hearing about the story of a little boy that, you know, was sort of almost, I don't know how you do it, but the family went around and each, you know, put a shovel of dirt on the casket, and this little boy, it was just a devastating kind of experience for him. I mean, how do you know those kinds of things?
Yeah. I've seen much, you know, it's a risk, but I've seen much more dangerous psychological damage to children by trying to keep them away from the reality. I've seen families that won't let the children come to a funeral service.
Even
like
for their parents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by...
I really remember once in my fifth grade, this one boy, his mom died, and it had been years ago, but in fifth grade he got pictures of him in the casket, and I was so loud, I was just thinking, we took the picture.
Karen's mother died when she was 11, and her father died like 8-9 years ago, and she said it was much easier when she was a child. I don't know. Ask her. Yeah, but what I'm saying is sometimes I think we think that children have such a much harder time than adults, and maybe they don't. There used to be old church laws against cremation, you know, and it was based on a literal thing about the resurrection, you know, how would God ever find the ashes to bring, you know, to resuscitate the body. But now, I think I want to be cremated. I think it just ecologically, since it's hard to put your body right into the ground, so it just becomes part of the compost. No, it's one thing we really need to look into is funeral laws, because we have this idea that, you know, one, I think you can do a funeral without a funeral director. You know, we have this idea that most of the laws are laws of how funeral directors have to operate, and not how what individuals can do. And I think I'm right on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I always wonder if you could have just pay a funeral director to do the paperwork. I wonder if that would be a possibility.
Well, you might find somebody.
You might find somebody.
One thing that in our family, I grew up on a farm, and a mile and a half up the road is the cemetery. And our family is the main family who takes care of the cemetery. And my brother's the sexton, and my dad's the treasurer. And most of the people buried in that cemetery are related to me. And I grew up with living kind of and playing in that cemetery.
Similarities.
And having fun there and learning about my family there and learning that they, knowing that this is where my mom and dad are going to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
And never knowing my grandparents, and that's what I know about them, that's where they are. And that feels real healthy to me. My brother, when he first became sexton of that cemetery, something's on my mind. The first person he buried was our aunt. You know, he's buried numbers of people that are related to us. You know, my part in that whole thing is mowing the lawn and clipping the grass.
Think of how healthy the old country church was, where you had the cemetery right around the church building, and you would go there, share the Eucharist just in the context of, and to see children playing in the cemetery, and how life and death are so connected, and how our urban American scene, everything is so structured to deny death. And if our meaning of life is on our wealth and on our progress, on what we're accomplishing in life, and we need to get those cemeteries and everything else out of the way, and even make funerals look like the person is just sleeping, because death is a threat to all of our gods. That we, I really believe that's why we've done that. First of all, try to avoid death in every way, and then when we do have to face it, we make it look like a sleeping. Even names, you know, cemeteries are called slumberland. The rooms where bodies are called slumber rooms. You know, we do all of this to just avoid the fact that this is body, dead as a doornail, rotting, going to dirt. It's over. And our only hope is is a resurrection. This opens up. This will open up a whole other discussion that we could pick up some other time. But the idea that when you look at a body in a casket and think that that person had a soul that flew out of that body to be with God is a Greek Platonic philosophical idea that has very little to do with the biblical faith. When I'm dead, I'm dead. Any life that comes after that is a gift of God. It's like one funeral sermon pointed to the body, this is a joke, pointed to the body and said, don't think of this as Joe, this is only the shell and the nut has gone home. Well, we have a few minutes. Let's open to page 206. I just want to briefly show the service of the burial of the dead in the LBW. Do you all have an LBW to look at? One thing, if you ever get in a congregation, encourage people to study death and dying and funeral practices, because, like I said before, the time of grief is not the time to learn theology. Okay. And the way this is set up is to have the casket covered by a pall at the church. However, do you see on the left, there's a little red line going down the page? Those are the parts you admit if there's been a cremation and this is a memorial service. That's your little hint of your little red line. What?
Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a church would own a pall. And I think it's one of the best symbols we have of equality in baptism, is to develop a tradition of the pall going over the... They used to be black, but now they're almost always white.
Is that only used at the church after the coffin's taken and let it bring down your stuff? Is that
going
on?
I think, that is a problem. Normally it's just used at the church, so you end up seeing the coffin anyway. Yeah, I think it'd be a wonderful thing to have a carpenter friend just make a pine plywood box. You know, there's nothing illegal about that at all.
The father of a friend of ours made his own coffin in the basement, so he needed it.
And
can you have a pall that would be like a quilt showing different scenes of the person's life or something like that? Or does it have to be a...
Be very appropriate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's something like the wedding quilts and people give them anniversary quilts.
Because it's, I think, just as we, when we talked about the wedding ritual, we said it really symbolizes two things. You know, one, the community, and the other, the vows. You know, and I think a funeral ritual, I think in the best sense, would have a tension of maybe three things. One, it is a time when we admit the reality of death. And then the other side of that tension, it's also the time we celebrate the triumph of Christ in the resurrection over death. And then in between that, we celebrate and give thanks for the life of a human being. Now, all three of those would be, and I think the most important, well, they're all important Christian ones, but where a Christian funeral is most counterculture is where the reality of death is admitted in the symbols. And, it's almost time. What you'll see, the burial of the dead is really the Eucharist. And you start with an entrance rite, just like you have in the Eucharist, only it's shorter. And then on page 208, now notice then the special prayers for special occasions like the burial of a child. And there's also, when you read all the rubrics, there's some of these prayers are more appropriate for somebody who is not an intentional Christian. And other prayers are more appropriate for somebody that had been really part of the life of the church. And that you figure out by reading all the instructions around this. But then starting at rubric 8 is really the service of the word of the Eucharist, where you read the scriptures just as we do in any Eucharist. The sermon follows the gospel as in any Eucharist. The hymn follows the sermon as in any Eucharist. And the importance of having the gathered people participate in the liturgy and in the singing and in the hymns to lift up their voices. Then the creed and the prayers, just like a Eucharist, any Eucharist. The bottom of 210 then is when the Holy Communion is celebrated, then the service continues with the peace and we have the passing of the peace. You'll notice when you read this service, too, how many of the words are meant to give comfort to the bereaved. If you read them, you can just read the sensitivity in them to bring comfort to those who are in grief. Then on page 211 is the commendation, where a very appropriate thing, this is before you would go to the cemetery, is... That if there's a small enough group of people to all gather around the casket covered with the pall and all put your hands on the casket, and you do something that we Protestants never thought we were supposed to do, you pray for the dead. And I was taught that this only Catholics do this, and one thing the LBW has revived is a very evangelical way of when a person dies, we don't stop praying for them. We pray that they may be commended to God. And then the committal is then what happens at the cemetery. That's on page 211, 212. Notice rubric 24. The coffin is lowered into the grave or placed in its resting place. That's if a box of the ashes goes into a slot or something. And notice that is an is rubric, not a may. The importance that this liturgy places to the lowering. And then it says, earth may be cast on the coffin, as the minister says. And this is where in a traditional we poured the little bottle of dirt. And then the recognition, the final recognition of this is earth to earth, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. Does it remind you of the Ash Wednesday liturgy? To dust you will return. And then a final prayer of thanksgiving, bottom of 213. And then again on 214, a final prayer for the dead, rest eternal grant her or him. And then a final benediction. And then the importance after that is sharing food. There's something Eucharistic about all of life and the need not to gather. Some of the saddest funerals I've been to is everybody gets in their cars and goes home. And the widow goes back to her house. And it's one of the beautiful things congregations do is often provide food and provide them. Well, that's a quick run.
That's a real meaningful. They're actually memorial services for infants and toddlers who spend all their life in the hospital.
Okay.
So, well, like an occasional doctor in a lot of nurses, other parents have been with those people the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
There's not all that many from the outside.
And you need
grandparents and all. And they're there, you know, just hugging and hugging.
You need
right
that.
And left.
Yeah, sure.
That helps.
I was wondering, like you were talking about the Greek idea of when the body's dead and the soul goes fluttering into heaven. What is the biblical context? Do you mean, like, in the service it talks about eternal life through our Lord Christ and resurrection? Mm-hmm. Is there some type of waiting room or limbo land that dead people go to until they get raised up, or do they go to heaven, or where did dead people go, or do I just not exist once my body dies and I rot and I'm no longer? And what gets raised up if that is true?
I think the main thing is that we're 99% agnostic about life after death.
What does that mean?
Don't know. Ginny Witt, I think, really had it together before she died. She really didn't know what was going to happen to her, but she says, I know I'm in God's hands. But when the Bible tries to work on it, the overpowering theme in the Bible is not the immortality of the soul, which is our typical cultural thing that inside of you have an eternal flame that lives on after your body dies. You know, but the overpowering theme in the Bible is that your body, spirit, soul, everything you is one. It's a unity, and when it dies, it all dies. And then our faith then says then that God gives a new gift of life after death. And very early Christians saw the resurrection of Jesus as a sign of what God does. You know, and Paul was. And the Gospels, you know, even use language of Jesus' resurrected body walking through walls, you know, and stuff. You know, it's a way of saying it was a new kind of a body, but it was very important to the gospel writers, that this risen, resurrected spiritual body of Jesus ate fish. You know, when you get all of this together, you can just be joyfully agnostic about what it's all about. Do you know what it is? Is that satisfying?
I saw a horror movie raised from the dead, and that's what I always think of, you know, these worm-ridden bodies raising.
I know Michael and I were talking about that too, after the whatever rubric 9 that says Jesus Christ is the firstborn of the dead. Mm-hmm. So then he started asking.
The way I sometimes think about it is that in death we leave our dimension of time, that Christians or perhaps others, depending on your faith, will be raised at the last day at the consummation of history with Christ, but that from the perspective of those who are dead, they're there instantly. That they don't have to wait our earth years till that happens. That they're there. It's sort of like when I go to sleep at night, as far as I know, in a second I'm waking up in the morning. That's what it feels like. And that... So from my earthly perspective, my friends who have died in Christ are not yet resurrected, but from their perspective, they're already there. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if that fits biblically or not.
That's helped me, too.
Yeah. This line, I'm just trying to get some insights on this line of the creed, it's always bothered me about Jesus crucified, died, and buried, and descended into hell, and descended into dead. Mm-hmm. I always took that as that understanding of his soul, you know, left his body, went down, and talked to the dead for a long time. But is it more of an affirmation that he was dead? I mean, he descended into death, basically. Then on the third day was rose again. Or where does that line come from? So we affirm that faith.
Dead.
How does one should know this?
I don't know. That's really confusing to me. Yeah, because there, you know, one aspect, one, the much more correct and ecumenical version is to say he descended to the dead, you know, which in its very basic, it just very simply says Jesus was dead.
That's what it means.
Uh-huh.
But, that's the first time I ever thought of it.
But I have to have a but. There's also a strain in the biblical thought that Jesus went to Sheol, where all of the dead are kind of in this shadowy, sleepy existence, and he announced his victory over death. You know, then you get mixed up into, well, what was he? Was he a...
That's what I always remember being taught, was those 3 days, that he, that's what he was doing during those 3 days.
And I'm comfortable with both strands are in the Bible and they're in tension with each other. The soul and the immortality and the dead as a darnail resurrection. And the Bible kind of lives in some of that tension. Really, it's because one really talks about discontinuity, the other talks about continuity.
But I said that line.
What? They left that out. Hell is the worst possible word to use in the creed there. Why we ever left. It was really, I think it was to pacify the Missouri Synod that was involved in this book, and then they left it anyway. So we got stuck with the word. That, if we had time, it'd be fun to have you sit down and start writing out your funeral. What would your memorial service be? What would it... in fact, think about that in our next section on healing. Let's just take the first 15 minutes to think about some of the symbolic ritual things that you think would be important for your funeral and that you'll want to write down and leave in a box someplace. I'll do whatever they want.
Speaking as a pastor, I really appreciated it when I had a few people that would do that.
Yeah.
We would either sit down together or they would give me a list of instructions and say, you know, this is really what I would
Some churches have files where they really encourage people to fill out forms and then keep their name in a file.
You don't have to
have
pre-arrangements.
Mm-hmm. One important thing that's often said is that your planning your funeral is really your last witness to what is important and what you truly value in your life and in your faith. No, and I haven't done this myself yet, but I think I have my last really chance in a way to share with people what is very important to me and what is important to our community.
You probably have charts.
I'll have charts and slides.
Yeah.
It's been 11 years, but I can remember reading about Titus Father's funeral. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had a big article about Trump trumpets and banners.
And at Kaya's father's funeral, they brought his books to the altar, they brought his writings, they brought his academic stole, they brought his academic gown, all the kind of symbols of it. I think even... I've had 3 funerals where we've laughed. You know, those have been the most healthy. When we just start giggling about the person that we're burying. You know, to me that is as wholesome. All those
were. Were they older people?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that would be hard at a child's funeral where there's or a tragic accident where there's so much ambiguity.